Good day, everyone. Welcome to the CSU Relentless Gardener Podcast. I am CSU Extension Horticulturalist Linda Langelo, and joining me today is Lou Ann Aiken, Garden Ambassador for Tagawa Gardens. Today, Lou Ann will be interviewing me, so let's get to the heart of the matter on Linda's pet gardening peeves. Hi, Lou Ann, how are you today?
Hello, hello. Isn't technology fun? So glad to be back with you. And I am loving the idea of turning the tables here and I ask the questions.
Uh-oh.
That's right up my alley.
Okay.
Would you want me to stop? You've given me a list of some of your pet peeves.
Well, you go.
And
you
there
go
are
from, you go
there
from.
Are many of them, which makes the rest of us gardeners feel more human, right? Right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We're going to talk about your we're going to talk about your top pet peeves, and I don't know if the list you sent me is in order. Well, actually, it may be, because you're talking about raking the leaves in the fall. What's the problem with that, my friend?
Well, you know, we have these wonderful trees, and like all plants, they produce food, and you know, photosynthesis happens in the leaves, and you know, as fall comes, and it clutter on our lawn, and they lay on top our beautiful lawns, and we decide we're going to rake that away. Some of us have gotten smart and mowed them into smaller pieces so that they can decay and add nutrients to the soil. So, you know, if we just rake them away and put them in plastic bags or put them in the trash, we have wasted all that nutrient value. And so many people still do that. And that could go being tilled into the vegetable garden and let it sit for 6 months over the winter. It could go in your perennial garden as some sort of a winter mulch and then be worked in. You know, we're wasting a lot of good value that the trees, you know, really worked hard to produce for us. And if you have a huge tree ring, why not just work them in or lay them on the tree ring if you don't live out in the rural parts of Colorado?
Right. And just to be clear, we're not talking about green leaves that might have fallen. We're talking about fall leaves that are down, they're drying out, and they're ready for a new job.
Right. This is the time of the year when the temperature, night temperatures start to lower, and the chlorophyll breaks down in the 50s and even more as it gets cooler. And so, you know, you take those leaves and you just either, you know, mow them into the lawn, or you can even, if you have a tremendous amount of trees grouped together, maybe you could take some that, you know, it still looks like a lot on the lawn, just put it in your garden or your perennial beds. I mean, it's great nutrients that shouldn't be thrown in the trash or shouldn't be put in a landfill, or, you know, or even burned for that matter.
And there's something magical about a leaf. Once it has dried out, it doesn't mat down the way green leaves do and create a virtual kind of concrete cover for your beds. You don't want to be putting down layers of the green leaves. You want to make sure that they have dried out and they just have a whole different constituency.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever told you the story about I had Christmas ornaments out one Christmas and I hadn't gotten all the leaves, you know, I'd left a few in this one perennial bed, and I had a deer, and it was leaning, the wind had come up, and so I went out, and I learned that 2 to 3, you know, leaves on top of one another actually kept the soil warm enough that I could readjust that deer within that bed without any problem. And the one side of the deer that still had stakes in it that were in bare soil, I had to go get hot water to actually move them out. So, you know, think about that. That's good protection for, you know, maybe some of the new perennials you've put in your bed in the fall, and you want them to, you know, have a decent temperature over winter. So it's mitigating that, you know, leaves have a good purpose.
And I think it's interesting to note that once they have dried out, they really can make some great insulation. Say if you're applying rose collars or something that you want to have air through it, but you still want them to have some kind of insulating value to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. you know, like I said, if you have a lot of trees, you know, you have all that many more leaves that you can use in so many different ways, especially if you're an avid gardener with, you know, huge rose beds or huge perennial beds like myself.
And are there any leaves, any types of leaves, any varieties of trees that drop leaves that you would not put into the garden?
Off the top of my head, for most people, I'd say no. I mean, the standard things, the maples, the elms, you know, the sycamores. No, I would say, you know, no. The hackberries, not necessarily, no.
And let's just talk, before we go on to your lengthy list of pet peeves, let's just talk briefly about why you would want to work these leaves in the fall as opposed to saving them until spring.
Well, if they have good contact with the soil and the microbes in there can help start to decay those leaves and release the nutrient value. And, you know, everything slows down even in the wintertime. So you're giving it until, like, you know, 5-6 months later when you're going in there, and you can really have the benefit of those without all of them leaching away.
Perfect. Leaching away nutrients that it takes for those leaves to decompose.
Right, right. And after they decompose, you know, there's more available. So, you know, you can do it. You can do it in the spring. I mean, if you want to do it sometime in April, but you're just going to have to wait longer. You're not going to get the most benefit from all the leaves that you've added. It just takes longer.
Yeah, exactly. And as a note, mea culpa, many, many years ago, before my master gardening classes began, I had great leaves. I put them on a bed about, I don't know, 8 inches thick. And that soil would grow nothing the next year. So a few inches of leaves, not 8 or 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Learn the hard way.
Oh, well, you know.
More is not always better.
Yeah. And like,
okay.
My,
all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like my deer story, it's, you know, I had, you know, 2 or 3 leaves on top of each other.
Yeah, exactly. All good. Okay. Second on your list of pet peeves is fertilizing your turf through the summer months.
Yeah, it's not necessary. It's too hot. It'll burn your lawn. You know, I had a story. A client called me. This was several years ago. I felt really bad for this lady. It was late summer, and she wanted to, you know, have another application of fertilizer. And the company said, okay, we're coming. And the date they were coming, and they said, when we apply, don't water till 24 hours after. And then she was calling me because she hadn't watered beforehand, and she waited the full 24 hours after, and she was going to have her daughter's wedding at the house. And when I came, what I saw was a burnt lawn. And I felt very, very sorry for her. So those things do happen. You know, I would have hydrated my lawn before.
And before and after?
Yes.
And so it's going on wet leaves and then being watered in.
Yes. So, you know, she had no other venue to go to but that house. So you hate to hear those stories, but, you know, if you fertilize in the fall, you know, at the end of summer, September, October, the grass is still a little active, that fertilization is the best time to fertilize. If you need to do it one other time in the spring, you know, like mid-April or early May, that's up to you. But, you know, the place and the way that the grass behaves is that you're going to develop that root system if you fertilize in the fall. If you fertilize in the spring, you're going to develop all the top growth.
Right.
So you
right.
want a better root system for your turf.
Is it true that you should only fertilize a lawn when it's growing and has some green to it, as opposed to when it's just browned out for the winter?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You are absolutely correct on that. It's too late by the time it's browned out.
Good, good. Okay. Any more pithy comments you want to make on your frustration with fertilizing lawns? Okay. All right, moving on. Moving on. Oh, this is a shared pet peeve. Watering the lawn when it's raining.
Oh,
and the problems that overwatering can cause.
Oh, you know, with all of the new sensors they have today, and I know not everybody has those systems, but, you know, even, you know, I see a lot of public buildings that have their sprinklers running and it's raining. And so you have to think also about the water holding capacity of that soil, because if it's sand and a foot of sand, if it only holds a half an inch and it's rained an inch and you're still watering it, well, I mean, all of that is drained and all of that is wasted. You know, an irrigation system is meant to help your plants survive on what they need. And it's important to do like the can test and put several cans around and then take a shared value of what those cans have collected, so you know exactly what your watering system is putting out. And then, you know, if it's going to rain and you know it's going to rain, sometimes, you know, we have a weather forecast, it doesn't happen, but if you know it's a sure thing, make sure your system is off. It's not only going to save you money, but it's going to save the water that's being leached out of that root zone.
So you're talking about a home audit. Do it yourself home audit with those small cans like tuna cans or cat
right.
food cans with straight sides. You
right.
spread several out over a zone, and then you just see how that water is not only being distributed, but basically what amounts you're laying down.
Exactly. And overwatering, a lot of times, you know, people say, oh, my lawn is yellowing in these spots. Well, it's not lack of iron, it's overwatering.
Right. And they just yellow out because they're getting that too much water and
right.
everything's leaching away. And right. Good. This next one also hits home to me, having talked, I believe, in our last podcast about my biblical grasshopper invasion, me and a whole lot of other folks. So you say rushing to have the first ripe tomato in your garden, it goes against science.
Yes, it does. You know, they're warm season crops and there's a certain temperature, and, you know, science backs all of those things. And if you want to get it out, you know, 1st of May or late April, and you do all these other things surrounding that tomato, you might end up with a stunted tomato. And, you know, warm season, that is its timing. And there's not a whole lot that you can do to change that unless you buy a variety that doesn't mind that it's a little cooler, that you planted a little earlier. But I don't really see the point to trying to rush to have the first tomato, because you may end up with no tomatoes.
And one thing, a mistake that I see people committing, that sounds like a crime, making, is planting in cold soil, no matter what the air temperature is.
Exactly.
Not a good idea.
Exactly. You know, rhubarb comes up out of the ground at about 45 degrees. And so, you know, you have to know and understand the different temperatures. You know, grass can start growing at anywhere from 49 to 55 degrees. And so you just research a little bit and figure out the soil temperatures and the air temperatures. And, you know, when the tomatoes can do well in 60 degrees air temperature, that is consistent, especially overnight, you know. And if it's cooler than that, it may be okay for a couple of days before it does warm up consistently to 60, but you're still taking a chance.
So planting too early, it's like we talked about with the fertilizer, too much of a good thing, too much early you know, planting time, too much head start, is not going to work well for you. And I found from firsthand experience, I was experimenting, and I live at 6,200 feet, so we're a little cooler here east of Parker on the Douglas Elbert line. And I planted some tomatoes one time in what you call season extenders, walls of water, whatever. And then we were to warm up the soil, and then we were getting a real cold snap. So this looked like some bizarre, you know, landing from aliens. I put rugs over them. I put all kinds of things to keep them warm, and it didn't make any difference. They did what they were going to do anyway, you know. So just wait for Mother Nature to say, yeah, give you a green light, and go ahead and plant and check that soil temperature before you stick those poor plants in there.
Well, and that's why I say timing is everything. I mean, it really is. The science behind it is always going to hold true. It's been tried and tested.
And just as a side note to the planting too early, there are hot temperatures that will always cause problems with the little flowers on tomato plants setting fruit. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, 85 degrees is your when, you know, like everybody understands that they'll mature up to the point of 85 degrees, and then they'll just sit there. And if they sit too long, there's the wind, there's the rain, there's pollination issues, and it'll just drop the flowers.
Right, right. And I did a little bit of research on when it's okay to pick your tomatoes. And we may have talked about this before. There were a couple of university studies I looked at, and they talk about the breaker stage of a tomato, a fruit, an actual fruit. And they said, as soon as it gets about a third just beginning to color, that's a breaker. And it's basically shutting off for the most part from the mother plant, except for water. You can pick those and they will continue to ripen. They're on autopilot. They will continue to ripen on their own. So why not pick them, put them in a cool, dark place. Don't put them in a windowsill, and just let the plant's energy go to ripening the remaining fruit that's on there.
Right.
And I get pushback because people say there's nothing like a vine ripened tomato. It's like, you know, whatever works for you. But science says, you know, science says, why not get that tomato out of there? It will fully ripen on its own once it's got that started to color up.
Right.
And so, you know, especially if you've got a lot of fruit, as I have, the grasshoppers have eased up here a little bit in my section of Douglas County. And all of a sudden my tomato plants are going, okay, let's make up for lost time. So as soon as I see a fairly significant pink blush, about a third, on my tomatoes, I'm picking them off and I'm getting a half decent crop for having had nothing a month ago.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. That's a good point. And I hope people do it.
Yeah, just try it with a few. I know vine ripened tomatoes, your grandparents said that. My grandmother probably said that too, but give it a shot because you could be costing yourself some harvest.
Well, it's still from the vine. I mean, it only has a third the red blush, but it's still from the vine.
Yeah. It's great. Okay, next pet peeve, not testing your soil before you amend it.
Yeah.
She's shaking her head here for anybody who doesn't have radio vision or podcast vision.
She's shaking her head. You get into all kinds of problems. I mean, you need a baseline. And if you haven't tested your vegetable garden or your perennial garden for a few years and you want to amend it and you add something else that it already has excess of, you're only making things worse. And it's better to know what's there and to understand what needs to be added to benefit those plants at that time. And, you know, we had a community garden, and the master gardener got, and this is another issue on top of that, horse manure. And manures have a lot of salt. And so, you know, after about, this was maybe fourth, maybe fifth year that he had decided it was free to add it. And well, unfortunately, you know, salt inhibits the water from the roots of the plant, and things were happening, and it was across the board. And I said, you need to test that. Did you test that? And we sent in for a test, and sure enough, the salts were off the chart. And the only thing to do is to you, they have to be leached in some
Right.
way. And
Which means watering, basically, right?
yeah, and so it was a dry season, lucky us, but it didn't help the plants that much at all. And so we cut that out entirely. And we went to a really finished compost. And actually we really, just be careful. Don't especially use manures in that repeated fashion. I mean, it's okay to add them in small doses, and especially if you have, lots of winter precipitation and things. But out here it was hot and dry, and there wasn't a lot of snow cover, and there wasn't a lot of precipitation, so it caught up with us fairly quickly.
I used to have some rescue burros, and I would add some of their manure in, but I found out quickly that A, you're going to get a lot of weed seeds that go through their system and are still viable. So I was growing a lot of ryegrass between my tomatoes there for a while, unintentionally. But it seemed to me that if it was aged and rained on and leached out before I added it, it has some nice fiber, but that's about all it has. That's the only significant contribution I can get from it. Is that fiber to loosen up clay soils?
Right.
But compost is probably a better way to go. But I get the it's free part.
Yes.
Okay. Not knowing what type of soil you have, this kind of plays into the amending. Tell me about CSU. Are they still offering really detailed soil tests that you can send in?
Yes, out of the Spur campus. Yes, they are. It's a great lab, so I encourage people to use it.
And I was at the Spur campus in North Denver by the Stockyards. That's the one you're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
Yes.
it's amazing. And they give tours, and I cannot encourage people enough. It's just a remarkable, and for people who kind of drive by it and haven't a clue what's going on there and what's changed over the past few years, it's well worth going to Spur CSU, right, pretty much in the heart of just north of downtown Denver. It's excellent. They have things there for little kids. They have all kinds of educational opportunities, but nothing about it is dry. It's just a really lovely, lovely way to spend some afternoon time.
It is a lot of great research going on.
Yeah, it's it
Yeah.
was very impressed. Very
Yeah.
impressed.
Yeah. So,
Oh yeah. Volcano mulching. Tell us what that
well,
is, and then I'll tell you what I have seen at a building I need to go to on a fairly regular basis.
not knowing about the soil type. Okay.
Yeah,
Yeah, that I have a lot of people who have a tree that's died. And sometimes they don't know what soil is on their property at all. And they want to know if they can have the tree that they already had that's died. And most of those times, that tree didn't do well in that soil structure.
Right.
And if they had started off on the right foot, understanding that, a newer elm variety, could do well in clay soils and then still do well in some other soils, but clay, if they had it would be a benefit to them. And I hate to see a tree die because it's not in the right soil structure.
Right. And speaking of the CSU soil test, how do people go about getting that done?
You'll have to go to the website listed for the Spur campus, and there's a link on there, and there's contact information. So, yeah.
Okay, so CSU Spur campus would get them there.
Yes, it should. Yes, it should.
And do they send out a kit that you then fill out with samples, various samples in your yard? How does that work, do you know?
I don't know. I don't know.
It's changed recently, but I would start at the CSU campus and see what that website does. Because when I had it done, and it's been too long, I admit that they want you to take dry soil for one thing, not wet, and they want you to take small samples from around your yard, unless you have a specific garden that you're planting that needs specific needs. But the instructions were great, and I think most everybody comes back and says no nitrogen, no nitrogen in your soil. So that's the biggest. And the plants are so dependent on nitrogen. So be prepared for that. But it also tells you, you know, some other things going on in your soil too, like your salt that you had.
Right. Well, and the thing is, they usually want you to collect and send in a cup of soil.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah. And nitrogen actually is one of the elements in the soil that will leach the fastest, that will move the fastest in
it
soil.
Moves, right. It moves. It moves. And some other things don't, surprisingly. And I didn't do well enough in chemistry to understand that, but it's really it's very interesting science.
Well,
Crazy interesting.
Phosphorus takes years and years and years to move just a few inches.
Right. Okay, the last one, as I was jumping ahead a bit, volcano mulch. Tell us what that is and why in the world do people do it?
That's a good question. I don't know. But, you know, volcano mulch is when you put this 10, 12 inches right up against the trunk, and it slants down away from the trunk, and it follows the ring all the way around. And that's why we call it, because it looks like a volcano with a tree erupting out of it. But, you know, it stops any moisture from getting into the roots and heats up around the bark, and it can cook the bark. I mean, that tree in a season or two will be gone.
And I think one thing that people don't always realize is the root system has one kind of tree tissue, if you will. The bark is a whole different kind, and it's not supposed to be wet all the time.
Right.
And you can easily set up a rot condition with wet mulch, you know, 10 inches up from the ground around the base of that trunk.
Yeah, as well as heating up at different times.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because you're going to start to decompose the mulch, turning it into a little compost ring around
and
it.
They still do it. To this day, they still do it in different places. And, you know, that tree could have had a long life, and it's going to be within at least two seasons, and lucky if it makes a third season.
Yeah, I will send you some pictures. I don't know if you have access to Facebook, your very self for your department, but a business I go to usually about once a week, once every other week, has at least 10 to 12, 13 inches of mulch right around the base of otherwise really nice trees. And it just breaks my heart. And I just want to go ninja and go up there and pull it apart, you know, at midnight. But it's just appalling. And it's that different tissue. It cannot accommodate, you know, that kind of environment.
Wow. Well, yeah,
there's probably 50 trees at this building that are volcano mulched.
Well, I had a friend in another state, won't mention the state, and she sent me a picture, and she said, now she's not a gardener, and she said, I don't think this looks right. Am I right? And they had a development that she lived next door to, and there were like 300 trees with volcano mulch being planted that day.
Wow. My theory is that somebody got a really good mulching contract. That's the cynic in me. It's like, let's use five times more mulch than we really need. You know. But I mean, even when the mulch is properly laid and in a 2-3 inch, you still don't want it right up against that bark.
Well, there's just a lack of understanding of, you know, I wish I had the after pictures of those trees, you know, the next season, to show this is what's causing what your end result was here with this tree.
Was the bark kind of rotting?
Yeah, well, I wish I had an after picture. I don't have.
Oh, you wait, yeah.
I wish I did. Because maybe that would, you know, make them more aware of their actions. And this is the consequence that you'll face. And I feel sorry for the property and whoever was developing that property. That's a lot of money. 300 trees. The trees are more than the mulch, and the mulch is the thing that got them.
Yeah. So my dog is checking in. So One last thought. If you had to pick the single worst practice that you have seen this summer going into fall, what would it be? Maybe from your list, maybe something else.
Oh, wow.
That just like stopped you dead in your tracks.
Oh, gee. Oh, yeah. Well, this is horrible. Having a client call you and saying, I hired so-and-so to come and spray the rocks under my tree. And these trees were mature, beautiful trees. And this was a young person in business and had a license and everything. And the mixes that he put, and I say mixes, of different 2,4-D and other chemicals together just simply killed those trees.
Oh, that's a shame. That is a shame. Just leached into the root system.
Yeah, and it was a hot day.
Oh, so it spread.
Yeah.
As a gas.
And they didn't do the math properly. And so for that area, it was way too much. And not to mention the heat of the day, you know, you could start off saying, oh, well, you know, it's only 70 now, but it's going to be 95.
Yeah. And the wind. What's the wind doing? What's the breeze
Absolutely.
Doing?
Absolutely. And this was, these were seasoned trees in front of a very nice business, and it destroyed the entire look of it. And now they have to start over. And fortunately, that young man is, you know, making reparations towards that, but it doesn't take away from the loss that they sustain.
Loss of the tree, cost of removing the tree, cost of buying and planting new trees. It's just so. CSU website is a great resource, so I would encourage people to go there and for example, you know, Google the volcano mulch, Google, you know, safe pesticides to spray over root systems. So there's so much educational value there just waiting to be you know, attached to log into. So I would definitely encourage people to use all that great information out of the CSU Hort Department to get the proper information and advice that they need.
Yeah, always, if you don't know, ask and research it. And sometimes the internet is not the best place to research it, but CSU is a reputable site. Extension sites are reputable sites. And if you still have questions, there are extension offices and, you know, agents to help you answer just about any question. And if we can't, there are always specialists that can. So other specialists that can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm proud to say that Tagawa Gardens, where I work in Centennial, they have a special kind of area of the garden center that has staffed by several master gardeners. So if you look, there's information is out there. Bring samples, bring pictures. I think the cell phone is one of the most underused gardening tools around. Look for the information. You can find the help, but do it before, not when you're thinking that maybe a mistake has already, you know, taken place.
Well, and the thing to understand too is that when people are starting off in something new, you don't always know the questions to ask.
That's
and
true.
so talking to an expert can help you formulate questions that you have, that you need answers and didn't know that you would have questions about. So that's part of that thing that's in there. You know, I don't care whether it's you're buying a house or you're making, you know, deal on the stock market and knowing what stock to buy. It's all the same. You know, each thing has its own lingo. Each thing has its own information.
Yeah, don't wait till you have a problem. Seek out a specialist and say, what questions should I be asking? What concerns should I have going into this process?
Better safe than sorry.
Absolutely. Well, Linda, you've made the highlight of my day putting you on the hot seat. We need to do this more often.
Oh, thanks.
I loved it. The pressure's on you and all the fun's for me.
Okay, good. I'm glad to make your day. Well,
you did indeed.
Thank you for hosting and joining me today.
I did feel kind of like the host, but that's great. I love it.
Good, good. A thank you to the listening audience. Tune in next time when we get to the heart of the matter on another horticultural topic.